The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at cooperadio.org.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, October 14th. Happy Wednesday. Today, I'm skipping the headlines because I want to take the time to bring you the full interview with Vancouver Mount Pleasant incumbent and NDP candidate Melanie Mark. Melanie first took office in a by-election in 2016 and was re-elected in 2017. And in July that year, she was appointed the Minister of Advanced Education, Skills, and Training. And Melanie is the first Indigenous woman to become an MLA in BC and also the first Indigenous woman to hold a cabinet position. I asked her about foster care, homelessness, and safer supply. As always, we'd love to hear what you think about the show. Give me a shout at meixi@cooperadio.org. Again, that's M-E-I-X-I at cooperadio.org. Melanie Mark, what a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's my honor.
Melanie, you've been in this position as MLA, now you're a candidate running for the MLA position, but you've been in here since 2016. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the three things you're proudest of.
Well, I got elected in February 2016 in a by-election. Jenny Kwan ran to become our Member of Parliament, which opened up the seat after 20 years. So I certainly didn't think I was going to get into politics, but I spent a very long time with the Representative for Children and Youth advocating for kids in care. And I was showing an interest in politics. Things weren't moving quickly enough. And the chance came. So I often, you know, I think the creator for that window of opportunity opening for me. And as I learned more about politics and what was going on in our province, I had learned that there had never been a First Nations woman to ever be an MLA in BC's history. So that was very exciting. And so when I was elected, I was the first person to hold a seat in the BC legislature. With First Nations background. So that's something I'm very proud of, and I really want to attribute that strength to my grandparents, Thelma and Willie Mark, my Niskanen-Gitxsan grandparents. And that's one thing. You know, in 4 years, it feels like dog years, to be honest with you. It's been a very, very busy 4 years. You know, I'm most proud of what I was able to do in opposition. I was a fierce advocate for kids in care. I did my best to hold the BC Liberals accountable for what was going on to kids in care. So that was my first year as an opposition critic. And then when I became minister in 2017, Minister of Advanced Education, Skills and Training, one of the first things I did at 6 weeks on the job was make it tuition free for former youth in care to go to college and university across this province, which was something that was very important to me and important to many of the young people that I know that have been advocating for that to happen. And I'll just share with you, you know, it's important to me as someone who was in care. My brothers were in care, and it's an area that, you know, I feel like we just haven't put enough attention to about giving young people the opportunity to have options in life and have a path that is a bit more positive. So those are the three things I would say: making history, holding the Liberals accountable, and opening doors for kids in care.
Great, Melanie. I wanted to ask you especially about the last point. I know I've heard you say that the day that you were able to create the tuition waiver program for foster kids in care or previous kids in care was one of the best days in your life as MLA. And I really want to ask you about that because I know often it's talked about as a tuition waiver program that almost sounds universal, but we know it's not. That we know that it's the minimum requirements that you have to have had spend at least 2 years in care, which is a barrier for some kids or former kids in care who, you know, really desperately need that but aren't able to access mm-hmm. that. Could you talk a little bit about why the eligibility criteria of 2 years in care and any thought about whether or not you would change that?
Sure. So I think the first point I would raise is I spent almost a decade with a representative for children and youth, and I know a lot about the different care status for young people in care. Most people don't know. I was a child in the home of a relative. I was also in a temporary, in a restricted foster home. My brothers were CCOs, which is continuing custody orders. So there's all these different statuses for young people that come in and out of care for various reasons. Not all of them become wards of the state. And so one thing that was really important to me was to open the door as widely as possible so that young people that weren't living at home, but I really want to emphasize that kids that are not at home for a variety of reasons had the chance to have this opportunity. because often it's those kids that don't have CCO status that have no supports. And they're the ones who find themselves in and out of the system with a social worker on a welfare, picking up child in the home of a relative, underage income assistance, and they never have benefits when they turn 19. So I wanted to open the door as widely as possible. And also, we had to set a bar somewhere. It was a very, very new policy for the provincial government. And so we set the age from 19 to 26. There's a huge variety of like youth definitions. Some people call young people, you know, 35 is the age, or 29 is the age, or 18 is the age. And so 26 was a starting point for us, just to be able to create the policy, knowing that we're going to review it, see how things go. A lot of people thought, hey, maybe no young people are going to go because they've all been in care and they won't have what it takes to go to college, university. And I really wanted to challenge that mindset. Now there's 1,200 young people that have gone through the doors, even with that criteria. But to answer your last point, there has been a call to action to change the age. And that's precisely what we've committed to doing in our plan forward with the BC government. If we're elected on October 24th, we're going to make it that there's no age limit. Siblings and myself and a whole bunch of young people that I know that were in the system, many of my friends that are my age, I'm 45 on Saturday, you know, people like me would have a chance to go to college and university. So I'm very proud of that.
That's fantastic. And I want to make sure I understand this point, because I spoke with Fostering Change a couple of weeks ago and some former youth and kids in care and existing kids in care. And they were saying to me that there was also that minimum amount of time that you've spent in care in order to qualify for the tuition waiver. I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, it's 24 months.
Cumulatively.
That one cumulatively.
Yeah, so part of that was an understanding, having spent 10 years working as a representative for children and youth, that some kids come in and out of the system, then they go home. And they come in and they go home. My mom really struggled with her addictions. Sometimes we're home, supervised access, then the kids are removed, then they're in the system, then they're out of the system. So we looked at it from a 24-month cumulative time of being in care as a base minimum that we wanted to create. We needed to create something. With all due respect, you can't go to the Treasury board table and ask for $2 million without some type of policy framework. And that's where we started, was to try to be as generous as possible. I had the support of Mary Ellen Trapella Fund. As soon as I announced it, she made a great article that said, like, we're really giving young people a chance to walk through the doors, and we should do better. Of course we should do better. And I really commend Fostering Change and all the young activists and advocates who are saying, please do more, because I don't think we've done enough for kids in care, which is why I got into politics.
Thanks, Melody. I also wanted to ask about agreements for young adults, which I'm sure you're more familiar with than I am, AYA, the support, our primary support mechanism for kids who have left or have aged out of foster care, and how eligibility requirement or criteria for that is also can be fairly narrow, as many advocates have said. What are your thoughts around that?
Well, I think as someone who has spent 20 years as an advocate in various forms, I think our job is to ask for politicians and government to make policy progressive, right? I mean, that is our job as people, is to call on public policy to be progressive and not rigid. Again, I spent a very long time at the representative's office, and there was a real sense that the AYYAs were too rigid and only some of the kids that had more capacity were eligible. And that was a criticism that the representative made. I would say that our government, Minister Conroy was responsible for children and family, tried to extend the age eligibility, because again, it was up to 24 and then we moved it to 26. And people might not think that's not a big move, but it's a move in the right direction. And we know that we need to do more to understand that young people transitioning out of care need that extra time and attention. The big call to action is most kids that are at home with their family have the luxury of staying at home with their family if they need it. And when you're in care, you don't have that option. You know, you turn 19 and what are the options available to you? Or, you know, you have to be more of a high functioning young person. We tried to change the criteria so that it was young people going to vocational training, maybe going to therapy, getting self-care plans in place to transition to adulthood. Because quite honestly, I really want to emphasize, being in care is traumatic. One thing people sometimes forget, I was in care because my mom was a drug addict. I wasn't dealing with feeling abandoned because I wanted to. I wasn't feeling, you know, the trauma of watching my mom addicted and have my brothers become wards of the court because I wanted to. So we have to remember that, right? Like, for those of us that have been through the system, I respect the advocacy from young people. I just hope that they understand I was there. You know, I found myself at the emergency room kicked out and floundering to try to get by because my mom was struggling. So we have to do better because those kids, we know what happens to them. I worked with sexually exploited kids. I know what young people will do to survive. I worked at Covenant House in the shelter where young people had no options because there weren't enough beds. So my heart has always been with young people. And that's why I really want to emphasize, like, we need to speak up and make sure that those public policies are more progressive. And it's not just for the kids that have it together, because when I was young, I didn't have it together.
What would you say to our young advocates who say, Melanie, you've been through the system, help us expand the AYA eligibility criteria so it's universal, it's not just 10% or so of kids aging out who get with AYA, it's more. What would you say to those advocates?
I would say thank you for the advocacy, and I take the advocacy seriously. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't take it seriously on Twitter. I'm a cabinet minister. I have 55,000 constituents. I have two kids. I have a big job. You know, the way we make change is we have to paddle together, and we have to say, look, how do you make this change? And working closely, which I would have, with Minister Conroy to make those changes. She's fully aware that we need to make it more open and to do a review of AYYA because it hasn't been like the most flexible program. So I would say thank you for the advocacy, and I'll make sure that we bring that message forward. I would just ask folks sometimes also to remember I was responsible for advanced education, skills and training. You know, part of what I did was made more funding so that there were Indigenous teachers. That's why I got into politics, because Natives should be in front of the classroom. And we're able to be seen as role models in another light. So I think the paddle together is like, help me help you so that we can amplify the issue and make that change. But to never stop. You know, the thing about determination is to never give up. As I said, I'm turning 45 this week, and I started advocating when I was 20 for some of these changes. And my gray hair is here to prove it.
Thanks, Melanie.
I'm showing up on the computer, okay. But tell them not to give up.
Okay, Melanie, I'm going to keep asking you hard questions because I think it's my job here.
Sure.
Melanie, let's talk about the Strathcona encampment. So we know that Mayor Kennedy Stewart, I'm not sure if I approve of all his wording, is very election-based wording in all his press releases, but he's said that him and City Council, and they have passed a $30 million plan to address homelessness in Vancouver and targeted specifically at Strathcona Park, this idea of leasing hotel space or leasing or purchasing hotel space. And city staff at the City of Vancouver have made it very clear that this is not sustainable for the City of Vancouver's finances and will need support from the provincial government. And Strathcona falls very squarely within your riding. Yeah. Any thoughts here? Will provincial government, can you personally commit to making sure that there's more funding from provincial government on this issue for homelessness in your riding?
Oh, well, first of all, I would share with you that I'm a relentless advocate. I mean, part of being relentless is like just not letting the issue go and to understand the issue, right? We've got a park that is designated as a park, and it's a park that people in the community really love, and they want to be able to access it for their own reasons. I don't believe parks are intended for people to live in. I actually don't believe that people should live in tents. I believe tents are meant for camping. And so, of course, we need to lean in. I call it the moose in the room. You know, people call it the elephant in the room. We can't deny that homelessness is a serious issue. And we have to understand why people are, what leads them to homelessness. You know, my interview a couple of weeks ago talked about people being failed by the residential school, people being failed by foster care, people being failed through the incarceration system. And to understand that some of those folks, they don't want to live in SROs. The slum lords led, right? We closed the Balmoral down, and some of those SROs are deplorable. I mean, we can't expect people to live in those conditions. So when you ask the question like committing, I'm going to use every day that I can in government to be asking for more housing. I lived in social housing. I lived in Skeena Projects. I lived in Little Mountain. I lived in Edmonds Court social housing. So I know that it works. Government has to invest in social housing to help people to transition to wherever they need to go in their lives, and they can't do that from a tent. Lots of issues to unpack, but it's not, I can assure you as well, I don't think it's effective for people kind of pushing fingers and saying it's your fault. You know, Jenny Kwan, as the MP, made it very clear, BC is being shortchanged from the federal government. That's math. You can't deny math. You can't deny that the check has not come to the West Coast in the way that it needs to. I also know that some of those supportive housings down by Union Street, by Oppenheimer, by Sugar Hill, have all made a huge difference for people, because I've met those people who have said, I don't have to pack up my tent and all my things and worry about my stuff getting wet and stolen and blah, blah, blah. So I have huge compassion for the issue. I don't think people should be in a park. And I think as a temporary mechanism, a lot of folks have been saying, even a temporary encampment in a vacant lot to help people get access to BC housing and some of the supports to transition, mental health supports, et cetera, to get stable is an immediate step. But the long-term goal is get people housing.
Melanie, I want to ask you about Safer Supply. So we know that recently the Safer Supply program was expanded. Now registered nurses can prescribe Safer Supply, but there's still questions about what will be available through this program. And advocates have been asking for medical grade heroin and alternatives to crystal meth. What's your take on that? What will be available through this, and whether it will be the drugs that many folks say is needed on the street?
So I don't have a precise answer on what will be available. I think that we need to do what it takes. I think part of politics and part of getting involved in this public life is about putting your neck out for people that need an advocate. My mom was addicted. My dad died in the downtown east side from drugs well before there was an opioid crisis. The supply is poison, as we've heard Judy Darcy say when she was the Minister for Mental Health and Addiction. So I think we need to do everything we possibly can. And that is scary for folks, right? Because let's face it, there are a lot of people that believe that addictions is a choice. And I don't. I don't believe that. I believe that we pride ourselves in being Canadian and humanitarians and all the rest of it. I believe that people should get the health care that they need. I think we should try to meet people where they're at. I don't know how many of my husband's friends and my friends have died from the overdose. And I think the stigma that goes with it. When I was in MLA, people called our office saying, how do we get the bodies out of the morgue? You know, it's so tragic. But I think, I don't know about you, maybe in your business, there's easy answers. I don't believe there's easy answers. I would have wished that my mom didn't have addiction issues, but some people do. And we have to help them. We have to have compassion. And we have to remember, like, 175 people dying in a month is horrific. It is a huge crisis. And so we all have to do our part. And I think how you do that is to destigmatize, decriminalize, make sure we can do everything we can to curb the poison supply, and acknowledge, like, if people want to go out and campaign that they're going to stop gang members, wishful thinking, no offense. I lived in the projects of Skeena. You know, gangs were around 30, 40 years ago. You know, any politician that campaigns that they can stop gangs doesn't understand gangs. What we have to do is reduce the stigma and make sure that we wrap people with the supports that we need and when they need it, right? Not 9 to 5. No offense. That's another thing that really bugs me. I'm not a fan of banker's hours. If we're going to help people in a crisis, it should be 24/7.
I'll say that as I was preparing for this interview, I hesitated about whether to ask you this line of questions, because I don't think it's entirely fair for me to ask the only Indigenous in this government before it was dissolved, MLA, about, I don't think you should show the responsibility for answering any questions about reconciliation only. I think it's a responsibility of all MLAs, but I will ask you anyway. When asked about reconciliation and John Horgan and the BC NDP performance in reconciliation, many First Nation leaders had many good things to say about it, but also, you know, sightsee and the handling of how it all went down with Red Soden were very sore points. And there was a Guardian report that pointed out that the RCMP was authorized. Notes from a strategy session from the RCMP came out and said that officers were authorized to use lethal force against land offenders. And the BC NDP supported the RCMP in its actions. I mean, what would you say about the handling of the situation?
So I want to go back to your hesitation to ask me the question, because I really want to kind of cement something for viewers at home to understand how long Indigenous people, including my relatives, have been fighting for our rights, right? First of all, we fought hard to get our rights protected in the Constitution and recognized and affirmed our right to self-determination. And then I want to remind viewers of the Royal Commission on Indigenous People that showed across Canada the deplorable conditions that Indigenous people face. And then I want to remind viewers about the missing, murdered Indigenous women and girls that, you know, I've said it before, if you want to get away with murder, then kill an Indian. I also want you to go out and ask how many Indigenous young girls have not been affected by violence. And you're talking to an elected First Nations woman who grew up in the Eastside projects. You can imagine the injustices that I've seen in my life. And then let's look at all of the Truth and Reconciliation's calls to action. Remind your viewers of the 94 calls to action. And then I want your viewers to think about the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and the calls to action there. So what I want to cement for you is there's a lot of work to do. And that work isn't on the shoulders of myself, right? I'm not saying I don't have a role to play as an elected official. Of course I do. I have a lot of work to do. But the work that we really have to do systemically is to work together. The systemic change is going to happen by paddling together. And when I talk about, you know, it might not be a big deal to open doors for kids in care, but that was a call to action of the TRC that I did. It wasn't in place. Other elected officials didn't do it. Getting teachers in front of the classroom, I helped do that. That was a call to action. So I would just share with you that I appreciate the complexity of the question. I had young people occupy my office. I met with those young people against all of the advice that I was given to not go to my office. I went because I wanted to hear from them directly. I believe firmly in hearing from people. I believe firmly in respecting self-determination. But what I ask people to do is to understand how hard it is to change these things alone and how we have to do some of that work together, right? And what I mean by that is what's really important, you just raised an issue of Strathcona. I want people to have a roof over their head.
And then also this idea of we need to make decisions that, you know, quote unquote, move the province forward. And then yet at the same time, these decisions have negative impact on probably the most marginalized group.
Think about it for a second. BC signed, we all voted for the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. What other province has that? If people think that that's not change, then you're telling me, with all due respect, there's no point. I shouldn't even run. What's the point of politics? What's the point of having legislation if it doesn't matter? People said we need the legislation to make the change, which we did. The NDP government made that change. Also, as minister, I made the first Indigenous law program at UVic, which acknowledges Indigenous law, acknowledges like my NISCA law. That's change. So I guess why I'm challenging you a little bit with all due respect is I think people dismiss that that's huge for people like me and our generation that have been fighting, and then my mom's generation, my grandparents' generation, we've been fighting for years to have our rights acknowledged. And now we're at a place where we're acknowledging we have to do better, but to say that we're going to fix everything overnight, it didn't get created overnight.
I think what you're saying to me, Melanie, is that you've been proud of the changes that have happened and acknowledge that there's more to be done. And
always.
You're asking
for sure. Always more to do. I mean, look at my freezer's empty from salmon. That is a travesty as a NISCA person. I grew up on sockeye. What is going on with the sockeye in our province? That is a huge crisis to me. We should all be devastated on what is happening to our wildlife. But I feel that as someone who grew up with an inherent right, that I have a right to live off our land. And right now we're basically hanging by a thread. That might not seem like a big deal, but it's a huge deal for us to be, again, when I talk about pulling together, there are issues that you raise that I would never deny aren't issues. They are. And we have to have the tough conversation. That's what reconciliation is about. Have the tough conversation, come to the table. You might've seen a hashtag I may have used. I always say, briefcase warriors.
Melanie, I wish I had more time with you, but I'm going to close off the last 2 minutes by asking you, what can voters expect from Melanie Mark? From you personally, not from the BCNDP platform commitments, we've seen those, that those have been public, but what can you expect from Melanie?
They can expect honesty. They can expect someone who's got a big heart. They can expect someone who's going to be fierce and tenacious on their behalf. They might not be public debates at the cabinet table, but I speak up and I use my voice because I want change. I'm relentless. I think that housing is a right. I think reconciliation isn't something that I'm going to solve, but we're going to solve together to honor my grandparents. I go to work each and every day to make change so that my kids don't have to confront the things that I had to face. And it's not just what I face as an Indigenous person. Growing up in East Van, I loved Woodward, Army, Navy, and the downturn East Side, and everything that was amazing about it. So I think people can count on me to be a voice that is compassionate, one that respects, you know, the values of our elders. You know, the way we treat people is something that isn't good enough for me. That's why I got into politics. I think people have a right to be treated better. And I believe, you know, I've often said to folks, when was the last time you slept in a park bench? And that's empathy. They can also expect that I'm extremely impatient. I'm as impatient as they are. There just aren't enough hours in the day. Lastly, I would say I'm extremely grateful. This is a huge honor that I have, and I'm going to do the best I can.
Melanie, thank you very much for your time, and please take care of yourself on the election campaign trail.
Right?
And we look forward to hearing more and speaking more with
thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Bye, everyone. Have a great day.
And that was Melanie Mark, Vancouver Mount Pleasant incumbent and NDP candidate. You're listening to The Pulse on CFRO. We're your super local morning news show here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. I'm Tan Macy. Please tell us what you think of the show. I'm very curious. I'm at macy@coopradio.org. That's meixi@coopradio.org. Chat soon.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.